You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hello, welcome back to episode 29 of the Untaming podcast. You know, when I began this podcast, we were still living in Portugal. My husband and I were at home all day, every day with our kids. And I remember talking to one of my friends about my first episode with Dasha Narváez, where we talked about all the components of the evolved nest. And for my own family's personal situation, the only aspect of the evolved nest I felt my children were lacking in was the one related to alloparents. Dasha had talked about how children need roughly 3 to 5 responsive caregivers in their lives. And in this episode today with Meredith Small, she also mentions a minimum of 3 responsive caregivers to a child. I bring it up because I remember even though we had both my husband and I with the 2 kids every day, I knew it was still not enough for the kids or for us. Like our daughter, the baby, she was 100% my responsibility. I did everything related to her. And I did most of the cooking, the laundry, the gardening, walking the dogs, feeding the animals, and a lot of the things related to our son also. Although he occasionally would wander off to help his papa, who, despite being at home, was still busy working hard on whatever project it was at the time, building our house, building an animal shelter, fixing a vehicle, setting up the solar power, working online, often putting in 14-hour days. And then his domestic tasks were to do all the dishes, the tidying and cleaning, and occasionally help me in the garden. But we worked to our own schedule. Our days weren't rigid, we could be as flexible as we liked. If we had a rough night of sleep, we could sleep in. If it was a hot day, we would spend it at the lake and often see friends there. Usually once every couple of weeks, we'd head into town or the city for the day to go shopping and run errands. We had complete control over what we did with our time, and that certainly made life easier for us. So we were pretty happy with this teamwork we had going on. Although despite the two of us doing all of this together, it was still tiring. And the conversation I had with my friend was that I knew that between the two of us, my husband and I were still doing the tasks, anthropologically speaking, of at least 3 people. And I remember talking about how hard it must be for a stay-at-home or solo parent who has to shoulder all of that alone. And now fast forward 18 months and my husband and I are getting a taste for what life is like for nuclear families where one parent is at work all week and one is at home all week. And we're getting a good understanding of the challenges of trying to fit in all the other things into those snippets of time that aren't now dedicated to work. My husband and I listened to an episode of the Yes Theory podcast this week about productivity. And it really hit home for both of us how we've reached this point of constantly having to appear productive. You know, we'll both find ourselves playing with the kids, enjoying ourselves, forgetting about everything else. And then all of a sudden we feel this almost like a societal pull to stop messing about and do something productive. For him, that's working on the bus he's converting or the website he's creating for a relative or reply to emails about various things or just work on his own personal projects that he wants to eventually turn into an income for us when we finally have our own piece of land again. And for me, it's usually more boring, domesticated things. Like the amount of times the kids ask me to play something and I say, hang on, I just have to finish cooking, do the dishes, make the bed, hang the washing, clean a mess the 2-year-old has made, find where the dog has hidden the other shoe. And this reminds me of a quote I heard as a teenager. A good mother has happy children and dirty floors. And I've learned, especially through rewilding, anthropology and psychology, that this need to keep everything constantly tidy and clean and organized and in its place is actually a symptom of domestication. Well, to be more precise, it's actually a symptom of unhappiness with our domestication. And so we need to feel some semblance of control, hence cleaning, to make us feel satisfied. But not really satisfied, more like reassured that we have an illusion of control. So therefore we control our lives. So this must be what we want. So we must be happy. It's like the same way that eating disorders often result from a feeling of lack of control in one's life And by having control over what goes into one's mouth, it gives them some semblance of sovereignty. I am the sort of person who would quite happily let the house be an absolute mess all day and play merrily with my kids and then tidy it all up at the end of the day, which is what I used to do in Portugal. Well, my husband would usually tidy up during the day as he would come and go, and if any friends dropped by, they were, well, they were like-minded. But now I feel I need to keep everything tidy and clean when my husband comes home at lunch and at the end of the day, since he has been working all day, and I don't want him to then have to come home to a mess to tidy, considering all the other things he already feels like he has to do. And on top of that, if anyone drops by here, people are more likely to see the mess and think I'm managing my time poorly, since it would be spent playing or cuddling with my kids, and that's not productive, or that I'm being a neglectful parent. I've certainly had some remarks about my kids' hair not being brushed that day, or food stains from the clean clothes they put on 5 minutes ago. I think what I'm trying to get at with this entire speech is that we're not supposed to be doing this all alone. It's simply not possible to be as responsive to our children as they need us to be in those situations. I know a lot of you listeners are stay-at-home parents, and I wish the world would acknowledge that we are literally doing the role of at least three people all day, every day. And it's exhausting, and things will slip through the cracks. And what makes it worse is I had a similar conversation about this with two different people in the past week. One said, I had no one to help me at all when my kids were little, but I was lucky because I had good babies. And another said, when I'm at home alone with my kids, I cook, clean, do the dishes, play with the kids, and get time for myself. I'm sure some of you have heard similar remarks, but you know, either these people are remembering events with rose-tinted glasses, or they're remembering the good days and forgetting all the hard days, or they've conditioned their kids to not ask for their help, or they're exaggerating, or they just have those rare miracle unicorn babies. But ultimately, they're perpetuating the fashion that asking for help is seen as failure or as a weakness. And not just that, but they're perpetuating the idea that everything stay-at-home parents are doing on their own is normal and that it has been normal for generations. This is simply not true. The thing that slipped through the cracks, especially in the last few generations, was the children. They were told to be seen and not heard, or put in a room alone to sleep, or not breastfed as long or as much as they needed because, well, the parent had a million other things to do. I know plenty of people who joke about how they had a rolled up piece of newspaper or a belt or a wooden spoon to fear, which kept them in line. But really, we all know that those parents were only teaching their children to respond to behaviour they didn't like with violence, and that children are inferior and they can't rely on their elders to teach them emotional regulation or trust or empathy for fear of corporal punishment. This practice of one person taking on the role of three is not evolutionarily or biologically normal for us. If you're feeling tired or exhausted, or like you haven't had time to brush your hair or catch up on sleep or have a shower or exercise, it's because you are literally doing the job of three people. A mother should be breastfeeding or breast sleeping with her young child while another is preparing food and another gathering food. Or perhaps one is playing with a child, possibly mentoring them in a new craft, while another adult starts a fire and the third is collecting firewood. Basically, this should be an easy job for three people, not a challenging job for one. Because the sacrifice that comes from trying to do everything is ourselves, doing things for ourselves, taking care of ourselves. I really wish, as a society, we would stop placing this illusion of productivity and busyness over the real priority, which is taking care of ourselves so we can just spontaneously play with and responsibly tend to our kids. Simply playing with them is good for them and us, cognitively and emotionally speaking, and it's good for our relationship with them. Oh, and don't get me wrong, I have a very supportive husband and family network now, especially my mum, who listens to every single episode of this podcast the very day it comes out. Thanks, Mum. My kids have an abundance of allo parents, their grandparents, aunts, uncles and cousins, whom they happily go with. So I'm glad for them that we're now reaching our allo parenting quota. But even with all of that extra support that I'm so fortunate to have, I personally often find myself What's the saying? One step forward, two steps back. It's not quite that for me. Maybe more two steps forward, four steps back, and then someone will help out and I'll go forward one more step, but never quite reaching that peak of achievement. Like a duck appearing cool on top, but paddling frantically below the surface. Actually, I wrote a sentence down the other day that really coupled with how I was feeling at the time. Every so often you catch snippets of life, but for the most part, you're just struggling to stay afloat in the chaos of domestication. Anyway, I'm rambling now. This has just come about as a combination of a listener saying they wanted to hear more about my day-to-day life and me who lives it thinking, why? And also wanting you all to know I don't live in a world of glitter and rainbows. And most importantly, wanting to let you know that I know how challenging and undervalued parenting is in this ludicrously domesticated world we have created. Our guest host, Mary Fransell, interviewed today's guest, Meredith Small. This is our last interview from Mary for the season. The rest of the interviews I have for this year are the ones I did myself. Next week will be with Amy Haas on how to avoid conditions such as gestational diabetes and hypertensive issues like preeclampsia during pregnancy. For now, here is Mary and Meredith Small.
Hello, everyone. I'm Mary Fransell, an IBCLC lactation consultant in private practice in Washington State, USA. I write a blog called What Babies Need, Exploring the Relationship Between Biology and Culture in Parenting. Today, my guest is Dr. Meredith F. Small, writer, professor emerita at Cornell University, and visiting scholar in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Small's current work on Venetian innovations, Inventing the World, Venice, and the Transformation of Western Culture, is coming out in December 2020 from Pegasus Books and is now up on Amazon. She received a PhD in biological anthropology from the University of California, Davis, and spent several years studying the behavior of macaque monkeys in captivity and in the wild. Although trained as a primate behaviorist, Small is now interested in how the intersection of biology and culture influences human behavior. Besides numerous publications in academic journals, Dr. Small is also a science journalist. Her work has appeared in Discovery, Natural History, Scientific American, and New Scientists, among many other magazines and newspapers. Small was also a regular commentator for National Public Radio's All Things Considered, and for 2 years she wrote a weekly column, Human Nature, for LiveScience.com. She is the author of 5 books, including What's Love Got to Do with It? The Evolution of Human Mating, Our Babies, Ourselves, How Biology and Culture Shape the Way We Parent, Kids, How Biology and Culture Shape the Way We Raise Young Children, and The Culture of Our Discontent Beyond the Medical Model of Mental Illness. Dr. Small received the Anthropology in Media Award from the American Anthropological Association, and her work was chosen twice for the Best Science and Nature Writing Volumes from Houghton Mifflin. She is Weiss Presidential Fellow for Excellence in Teaching at Cornell University and has also been honored with the Russell Award for Teaching and an Outstanding Educator Award from the Merrill Presidential Scholar Program at Cornell. Last night, she got 8 hours of sleep, and for breakfast, she had a homemade banana scone and a Starbucks Frappuccino. Dr. Small, welcome to the Untaming Podcast. I am so thrilled.
Nice to be here. I'm always happy to talk about babies.
Oh, wonderful. I am just so thrilled to talk to you. Your book, Our Babies, Ourselves, has had a tremendous influence on both my parenting and on my research and writing. So could you start by telling us how you became interested in the anthropology and the intersection of biology and culture? How did that start for you?
Well, I think it's really my training as an anthropologist where these days, a lot of the graduate students are trained very specifically in one subfield, but I was lucky enough to be trained on all 4 subfields of anthropology, which include sociocultural anthropology and biological anthropology. And in my mind, the anthropological view is really one that is deep in time, and by that I mean evolutionary, and broad in scope. And by that, I mean across cultures. So I think I have always been interested in those two intersections. And as I got trained, and then as I began to teach 18-year-olds, that's what I think most everybody is interested in, especially Americans, Western culture. We want to know why we behave the way we do. It's a combination of those things. But I find that personally really fascinating.
Wonderful. So human infants are born extremely immature and require extensive caregiving for a longer time than many other mammalian young. So what are some of the reasons for that, and how does that influence parenting?
Well, we have to look at the human fossil record to answer that question, because, of course, we are genetically closely related to chimpanzees, and 5 or so million years ago, we shared a common ancestor with chimpanzees, and they're not necessarily quadrupedal animals, but they're not bipedal. They don't stand on, they don't do upright walking. And so when that started to happen in the human fossil record, probably around 3 million years ago or so, 3.5 million, our human ancestors were short people called Australopithecines with small brains, and the adjustment to becoming a bipedal creature meant a reorganization of muscles and also of the human pelvis. So our ancestors went from having a chimpanzee kind of pelvis, where the blades of the pelvis are long and thin, and the opening for the head of a baby to get through is quite wide. And of course, chimpanzee babies have very small brains anyway compared to humans, so out they go. But then you have this bipedal human female pelvis with broad attachments, muscle attachments on the sides and the back to keep the body upright. So the iliac blades of the pelvis became short and broad. The sacrum started to point into the pelvic canal, and this made an oval-shaped exit for the birth of our early ancestors. At first, this was not a problem because they had very small brains, but about 1.5 million years ago, there was a huge increase, a doubling in the size of the human brain at the phase called Homo habilis. That then was a conundrum. How do you, if evolution would select to change the shape of the pelvis even further, women would not be able to walk. And so what we have is sort of a evolutionary conundrum. And that was solved by having babies have a 9-month gestation period, and they're born, their heads aren't big enough given to what they're going to grow into, but so they're born neurologically unfinished. Probably they estimate about 3 months too early. So they can't hold on, they can't sit up, they can't follow mom, they can't do any of those things.
Right, right. And how does that influence parenting in human societies generally?
It means that human infants are born neurologically unfinished, means that they can't take care of themselves and they can't even defend themselves. And so they're born with the expectation of being taken care of. And so when we make decisions that disconnect that bond, it's really not how human babies are designed or what they're designed to expect.
Right. And it's not like they're a cow or a deer or someone who can just get up and walk and follow That's along right. with their parents.
That's right. That's right. And so the development takes, you know, a really long time. And we know that kids don't walk till they're around a year old. And during that period, they really rely on this connected bond between the infant and some other. It doesn't have to be mother, but it's an infant and somebody.
Right, right. And how do you see that in primate societies, and how does that relate to some of the early humans? Has that connection there?
My experience is mostly with macaques, my personal experience, and I've seen a lot of births, and babies are immediately carried, but they're able to cling Of course, mm-hmm. their mothers have fur, so that helps. Right. They can cling on to that. And they make facial expressions. But they are also a little dependent, but not for very long. Mm-hmm. Chimpanzee babies stay with their mothers. They nurse between 4 and 5 years, and their mothers are carrying them on their front or on their back. But they still are a little more, for their species, neurologically advanced than human infants are.
And also, I think there's the composition of the milk, too, sometimes also makes a big
Absolutely.
Difference. And I don't know if you can talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I mean, you're a lactation specialist, so you know all about that. But human milk is very low in fat. And so it really is designed, not like a seal, where it's high fat and the seal goes off into the water, you know, to eat fish. It's very low in fat and really is designed to be delivered on demand or continuously, which, you know, Western culture is frightened of more than anything.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So can you talk a little bit also about modern hunter-gatherer cultures or modern nomadic cultures? I'm not sure what the phrase is right now that's the most current term. But I know that, you know, obviously we can't go back and study the cultures that we came from, except from the fossil record, but there are some modern cultures that still maintain those practices. Can you talk a little bit about some of those that you've studied and what they, how they tell us, what they tell us a little bit about the roots of parenting?
You know, anthropology is a pretty recent discipline, and it wasn't until the 60s and 70s that anthropologists began to study babies and infants, and they were most interested in hunters and gatherers, and especially savanna hunters and gatherers, because there's all kinds of hunter-gatherers, people in the Arctic, people in deep forests, etc. But they were interested in savanna hunters and gatherers, assuming that was probably the environment that our human ancestors, because they evolved in Africa, was probably like that. So there was a very strong push to study the Tsang, in Namibia and other places. And so a lot of work was done by Mel Konner and people like that, studying, gathering information. And that's a really good comparison. But of course, there are many kinds of agriculturalists, pastoralists, nomadic people around today. I think in Western culture, we forget about this, and it's always been one of the most fun moments of my teaching when I explained to students that not everyone has a cell phone, that in fact, there are still people out there all over the world who are hunters and gatherers, or combination of hunting and gathering, a small plot horticulturalist. And so if we get out of our envelope, but everybody is like Western culture, you get a better picture of what humanity was like, because for about 95% of human history, we were hunters and gatherers.
Right, absolutely. So could you tell us a little bit about the general ways in which parenting differs between more industrialized and more traditional societies, not necessarily hunter-gatherer societies, but societies maybe that have different parenting practices because of their, you know, agricultural roots or whatever it is. So could you talk a little bit about how that differs in those general societies?
And those differences also show up because of differences in belief system. Mm-hmm. How much cultures cherish the family, whereas in, you know, North American, and it's individualism. So those kind of belief systems also figure into this. I think you can generally compare industrialized societies to all others. And the outlier there is Japan, because it is an industrialized society, but their belief system is very different than other first world cultures. So, but in general, in Western culture, let's call it, and by that I mean Europe and North America, there is a move towards kind of controlling babies, putting them to sleep in their own room. And America is the most extreme in all this, because many European countries do not follow that kind of pattern. But in general, if we just want to say America for a minute compared to other cultures, in America, babies should sleep through the night. They should sleep alone in their own room. They should not be picked up when they're distressed. They should be ignored. They should not be carried a lot because that will spoil them. In contrast, all the other babies in the world grow up being fed on cue when they want, being picked up and fed when they're under distress, and they always sleep with someone. It might not be mother, it might be brothers and sisters. They do not sleep alone. Or they're in their own little bed, but in the same room or, place as the mother. So you have two different patterns, one in which there is this idea of making a self-sufficient individual, and the other where the belief is not that. That doesn't even occur to people. It's more that this baby is part of a social group, and now we're all going to take care of it, and we're going to make it a citizen who interacts with the society and not selfish. So those are the two big contrasts.
Excellent. And can you talk a little bit more about maybe about Japan or perhaps like such India for where people, sleep together on a regular basis? Some of these industrial societies that differ from ours in the lack of, wanting them to be so independent.
For me, one of the most interesting comparisons is among European cultures, because there are huge differences between, say, Italy and the Netherlands. Huge. Mm-hmm. And I always find that interesting. So in Japan, the belief system is about family loyalty, family integration, and keeping everyone together. So I'll tell you this little story. Once I was teaching, doing a discussion with a bunch of students, and I had about 10 kids in front of me in a circle, and I said something like, in Japan, children always sleep with their parents, and I had a Japanese-American student in my there, and so I said to her, tell me if I'm saying something wrong here, and she said, oh, no, when I go home from school, I always sleep with my parents, and I literally watched the other students kind of jumped in their chairs, like they could not imagine going home and sleeping with their parents. But for her, it was perfectly normal. And so that kind of family and societal integration is very much part of Japan, even though it's a highly industrialized society. I know in Italy, there is a focus on what the baby eats. And there's a famous article where the ethnographer was saying the mother keeps shoving a spoonful of pasta at this baby. And when the interviewer says, aren't you kind of forcing it? The mother goes, we'll get used to it. Because, eating is the most important thing. In the Netherlands, people will leave their babies in a baby carriage outside a store. And that's considered perfectly normal. And we've heard of people and immigrants from New York, Netherlands or others, or Scandinavian countries, getting in trouble with the cops because they left their kid outside. So we see all these patterns. We see them within America with different cultural histories. And one of my favorite instructions was about how pediatricians have to learn what they hear from their clients and not react to it in a Western way when they hear that the 12-year-old is in charge of the baby, that it's really okay. The 12-year-old does really well. So we have to constantly fight our judgments of other cultures. And all of us do this, everybody. They do to us and we do to them. Yeah.
I found it really interesting in your book, Kids, about how you talk about, that when we do Western types of testing for child development, that some cultures, it doesn't make sense at all because they're not used to responding to adults or whatever it is.
I'll tell you, when my daughter was about 18 months and we went to the pediatrician and just got a nurse practitioner, and she turned to me and said, how many words does she have? And I said, I don't know. I never counted them. And she said, well, we like them to have 22 words at this time. And my response inside, I was thinking, you have no idea who you're talking to. And secondly, I said, I bet you do. And that was like the end. I came home. I was so angry at this. And she told me, we like breastfeeding to stop at a year. And again, I was going, why? You know, I mean, it was not a good visit. And when I came home and I told my husband at the time, he said, you are never taking her to the pediatrician ever again. And when he took my daughter for the next checkup at 2, the real pediatrician came in and he said to him, do you understand her? And my husband said, yes. He said, does she understand you? My husband said, yes. He went, check. That was the right question. Exactly. Because as a pediatrician who's looking outliers, he's making sure she's not, she can hear and she can speak and she can communicate.
Right.
And
I think it really drives a lot of Western parents kind of crazy because of all this, you know, expectation that this has to happen at a certain time and this child has to breastfeed a certain number of times and space them apart. And it drives them crazy, I think. And unfortunately, that's part of our culture. And I would like people to relax a little more about those things.
Well, and you know, oddly enough, we turned to Dr. Spock, you know, who said, you know more than you think you do. Right? And nobody believes that. And when I give people advice, because people are always asking me, of all people, for advice and on children, and I just say, carry the baby all the time, sleep when the baby sleeps. That's all the advice you need. You don't need anything else.
Right. And nurse them when they need to nurse.
Nurse them when they need to nurse. Because really, I've had a teenager. The hardest part is coming.
Exactly. So one thing I think that in our society and in Western society, people really worry a lot about independence. That's just a huge thing that if the baby isn't made independent at a very young age, they will be so dependent and that scares people. Can you talk a little bit about the independence of adults in the cultures where they have these practices of keeping the babies close?
Sure. And where that comes from, this, and of course it came across, you know, I guess with the Puritans, but it goes along in America with our economic situation. We believe people should make their own money and they have their own business and they should pay their own bills. And it breaks down, especially during these COVID times, but also economic times, where you see kids graduating from high school or college and they can't afford to live somewhere else. And we're starting to take on a more Italian kind of thing where everybody continues to live at home because we just can't. But we still expect, we want our citizens to make decisions for themselves. But what's interesting is absolutely no one has ever confirmed that those practices of putting a baby to sleep in a room by itself, et cetera, not picking it up, actually translates into a citizen who is independent. And in fact, Jim McKenna told me that there is some work on kindergartners when in fact co-sleeping kids are more independent by measures of, do they go over and pick up toys by themselves? Do they go to the bathroom themselves? They are very autonomous, more so, probably because they feel secure. But in fact, there are no real studies following co-sleeping babies, let's say, and non-co-sleeping babies, and how they turn out as adults. So these belief systems are all assumptions.
Absolutely.
And that's the problem with them. And we all have them. Yeah. I don't know what we'd be without belief systems, but... They're assumptions, and assumptions can be changed, they can be studied, et cetera.
And, you know, there is a lot of anecdotal evidence among people that I know that have been in La Leche League and other places like cultures that promote closeness with babies when they're young, that the parents are, that as they grow older, they do become very independent. So even though it hasn't been studied, there is, you know, there's very, and it is very strange the way this whole behaviorist mindset that came from John Watson has just kind of stayed with us, even though it really has never had any research to prove it in any or disprove it.
It hasn't.
Yeah.
It hasn't. And what if you suddenly wanted to bring up babies that were integrated into their family? Would you know how to do that? You know, the patterns just, you know, go on. And it's also true that, sort of an aside, but the pediatrician is not the place to get advice because they don't get any training in medical school or their residency on behavior. They don't get anything.
Exactly.
And pediatricians have told me, I just tell them what I did or what my parents did, because that is not their job. Their job is sickness and wellness. So if your kid is sick, you go to the pediatrician. if your kid is driving you crazy, don't go to the pediatrician.
Exactly.
That's the place to go. Anyway.
Absolutely. That makes total sense. So can you just talk a little bit about some of the difference in more traditional cultures and how they, you know, approach parenting in different ways?
Well, there are not that many studies about babies and infants in other cultures. Of course, Alma Gottlieb, who I'm sure you know, has written the most fabulous ethnography, and her two books, World of Babies 1 and 2, give you some comparisons across cultures. But anthropologists weren't that interested in babies. They were interested in adults, and only with Gottlieb's work and other people are getting a sense of how the babies are now and how they're reacting to things. I think there is probably as many different ways to deal with babies as there are people in the world or cultures in the world. Of the ones I know well, what I see are a more communal approach to infants. I had a student who lived with the Yanomami in Brazil for a while, and she told me, I said, what was it like at night? She said, well, you know, everybody's asleep in this longhouse, and when the baby wakes up, there's always somebody awake, and they take the baby. And I think, wouldn't that be great if we had that in this culture? And Jim has always said that humans are biphasic sleepers. We're really meant to get up in the middle of the night and take a nap in the afternoon. So that part of our evolutionary heritage shows that expecting babies and adults to sleep through the night is kind of stupid. And we really should allow for more flexibility, which means you should be able to take a nap at work as well. So our economy has shifted the values or the diurnal rhythm of work, household, and family. And so that makes it difficult. But in general, babies are always somebody. Sometimes it's not mother. Sometimes it's an older sister or cousin. And 99% of the child care in the world is done by other children. And they do it well. And there's always an adult around, but Americans get shocked when they see a 7-year-old carrying a 3-month-old baby. You know, they just can't bear it. In some cultures, there is what I guess we'd call wet nursing. In other words, someone else is feeding the baby if the mother is off at work or something like that. But mostly it's that there's always someone who is holding the baby, always,
right,
until it starts to walk.
And I think there's one culture in particular, one traditional culture, I don't know if it's the Aceh or where the fathers are extremely involved. I think you may have written about that.
Yeah, the Aceh are certainly like that, and there are other cultures as well. And the anthropologist Sarah Hurdy has been very interested in the variation across the world in paternal behavior. And she thinks it's a selective advantage for humans. We have many fathers who are deeply involved and some who are not so much. And that has a lot to do with workload and who goes off to work. In a hunter-gatherer society, the men mostly are hunting, and that's a pursuit that might take days, and the women are gathering, and they're going out every other day. And so it's a totally different rhythm to the day. But they have lots of people around them to help with childcare, and that's the key.
Absolutely. So there are certain cultures, not just hunter-gatherer or traditional cultures, but co-sleeping, bed-sharing, extended breastfeeding, baby-carrying is the norm. Is there anything particular they have in common? Is it the family structure that's really key, or is there anything else that you can think of?
I'm not really sure about the answer to that. I think it's a different attitude about what they want from babies and the expectations that they want from Americans. As Jim famously said, Americans treat their babies how they want them to be, not how they are. So it's possible that people who are more what we would call more solicitous towards babies are just people who are treating them, see what they see and they react to it. They're not trying to mold that baby to something.
Absolutely. So could you talk a little bit about something that you explored particularly in your book, Kids, and that is that childhood is a uniquely human phenomenon. And so how is that the case, and how does childhood vary among different cultures?
Yeah, childhood is this extended time that, let's call it between and a baby is, or child is walking and talking, and then when they're reproductively active. So that's childhood. So it's interesting that it is so long for humans. If we compare it to other animals like macaques, there is a juvenile period, and then boom, they're adults. So the anthropologists have always been interested, ask the question, why is it so long? And the first answer that people think about is, well, because they have a lot to learn. That one doesn't seem to have all that much credibility, because studies that have compared the abilities of children in terms of gathering food show that they're perfectly capable of both hunting and gathering. They can't carry a lot until they get bigger, but they're perfectly skilled in doing that. So it may not be learning, but it seems to be a period in which these years are inserted into the human life course. And the anthropologist Barry Bogan has suggested that it's inserted not for this learning and everything, but so those kids can help the mother with the newest baby. So they become helpers, and that improves, she can then reproduce again. I find that a very intriguing idea and a possibility. But we really don't know the answer. We just have a very long childhood.
And in our culture, childhood is a time where you go to school and you learn and you play. But can you describe what childhood is like in some other cultures? I mean, there's a lot more work that goes on.
Absolutely. It's one of my favorite points when I teach the anthropology of parenting. When I begin to talk about what life is like for, let's say, a 10-year-old in another culture. And in fact, these kids work, not in the sense of child labor as we think about it during the Industrial Revolution, but they contribute to the household economy. And by that I mean, if it's an agricultural society, the kids weed, they might help harvest plants, they might help take care of animals such as pigs or cows or chickens, so they get the responsibility of doing that. They certainly do all the child care, except when mother is home and carrying the baby. So they go fetch water, they find firewood, and it's not as if they're doing that 12 hours a day. They're doing that some part of the day. But they don't, if they have a chance to go to school, which sounds really good, those duties then aren't performed. So that's a difficult conundrum for the families. They want their kids to be educated, but they're used to having all this labor. Whereas in Western culture, we don't ask that of our children. I mean, try to get them to do the dishes. And so they have this period. So that's why in Western culture, we think of childhood as this free and fun period. Because all we require is for them to go to school. And if I ever heard another person call school, this is your job, I thought I would scream. Because it's not a job. It's not an income-generating thing for the family. It's just where we choose to have our children learn what we believe they need to know. But kids in other cultures are learning what they need to know by watching their parents and by doing it. Doing everything.
And I always found it, especially after reading what you wrote about, it's so interesting because so much of children's play is imitating adult work, you know, where they sweep or they, you know, set the table or they hold babies or even just building with blocks. They're doing work, but they're not doing actual work. They're just doing play work.
They do. They are. And if you look at other cultures, the same thing happens. Little kids imitate their parents. Boys imitate their fathers with little bows and arrows. And girls imitate their mothers with little cooking pots and everything. But the difference is they get to handle a real baby. They don't have to use a doll.
Right, exactly. And I think it is a difficult thing to translate in our society because work is not done in the home as much, right. So that, you know, you couldn't just leave a 10-year-old at home with a toddler. when you go off. It has to be
that's
when
right.
the parent is close by.
That's right. And that's the intersection of economics with belief system. So we have this pattern where we go to work at 8 o'clock, we come home at 6 o'clock, that's work time, not dealing with kids unless you're a teacher, and then you have your family time. And you don't see that in other cultures. There is, especially in hunter-gatherers, pastoralists, whatever, there's more fluidity in terms of how the day goes by and who interacts with whom. But we really section things off, just as we do in the classroom, when we divide them by age. No,
same
thing.
Absolutely. Because in other cultures, it's groups of multi-age children learning from each other.
Absolutely, and they learn really well that way.
Absolutely.
Really well, yeah.
So, you know, culture is something that I've studied because it really just seems to have such a huge influence on human behavior. And why do you think that it's like such a pull on humans and parents in particular? Because they really feel, I think, very guilty sometimes if they do things that go beyond, that are not in line with their culture. And how, why is that such a strong influence, and how does it impact parenting in more Western societies?
Social anthropologists say that identity is everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that sentence because it is so profound. It's such a simple sentence, but it's profound. And I've written a lot about the issue of identity. We seem to be a species that needs to belong. We want to belong to something somewhere. And when we don't have large, strong families, we invent them through our hobbies, things we like to do, interests we have. One of the things I did with my Cornell students, when I taught a course called The Anthropology of Everyday Life, the first thing is I would ask them is, we're going to go around the room and give us your list of identities, how you see yourself. I mean, that's the only way to put it. And I begin with myself, and I say these are not in any order, and they change through time, and they change through the day. But I see myself, I identify myself as... And I begin, you know, a mother, an anthropologist, a white woman, a knitter, you know, things like that. And I always say, you notice there's nothing in here about family besides a mother. There's nothing in here about ethnicity, though I have an ethnicity. There's nothing about religion, because those things personally are not important to my own identity. Then we go around the room and I hear fascinating things. Religion comes up. Ethnicity comes up, hobbies, all kinds of things. And everybody gets to the realization that they have all these layers of identity that they skate through during the day, during their lifetime, during everything. But when someone doesn't have an identity, such as an immigrant population that loses their homeland, that, you know, that comes to another country that they don't understand, there is great mental illness that happens then because they've lost a sense of connection. And when people do immigrate, they hold on to a lot of their identity in their language, in their food, in their dress, because it is so important. So the evolutionary question is, why is it so important? The only thing anybody has come up with is that having an identity and belonging must have been selected for because it helps us stay alive and reproduce as a group. So we are social animals who are interpersonally connected beyond kinship, and this is how we do it. If you belong to a group, it means us, and means we're different than the them. And then we can do nasty stuff to the them because they don't share our identity. And the hope is to bridge that us and them and make a more collective identity. But I think this is a subject that anthropologists, psychologists, sociologists are just beginning to really study and understand, and it fascinates me.
Absolutely.
How we identify ourselves.
Absolutely. And finding your tribe as a parent, I think, is essential, particularly if you're going outside of the norm of your current culture. And I know that I found that in La Leche League, because what felt right to me was not what, you know, I was being told by the pediatricians or the experts. And I've started a Facebook group, the experts, quote marks, that I really, I recently founded a Facebook group, and we have over 80,000 members now about, you know, biologically normal infant sleep, because there are so many people out there who feel so guilty about, you know, sleeping with their children, even though that's a biological norm. And so they need other people to connect with so that they don't feel alone. So.
That's right. I remember, I mean, my niece and nephew are in their late 30s now, but I remember when they were babies and years after, and I was writing this book, and my sister said to me, I always slept with my kids, but I never told anybody.
Right.
Because, and she said they were the happiest years of my life.
Absolutely.
Two very independent kids. And I was always vocal. I always would have slept with my daughter, and I told anybody, you know, and I can remember my mother disapproving of me. And then when my kid was around two, she said, you were right.
Absolutely.
She is amazing. and, you know, it was nothing, but I, you know, people disapproved. I didn't care. You know, I just like, here, read this book, leave me alone. But as a primatologist, I would have never done anything different than that. And I think it's getting to people to trust their own positive instincts.
Absolutely.
You know, they're negative ones, but they're positive ones. And I think that's the conundrum for the United States. Is I also go back to what I think is really important in our current culture is the decrease in the birth rate. So if you have eight kids, you don't have any time to worry about all this. But you get other kids, your older kids are taking care of the younger ones, and it's a more organic sort of thing. But when you only have one child, or you have two, you've got all your eggs in one basket, and you just keep watching, obsessively watching that basket. And if you're a woman who has chosen an outside-the-home career, and you've been successful, and now at 35 you're having a baby, and here is something that is totally new to you, because you've never babysat anybody. You come from a generation where you didn't have many sibs. You didn't have any experience. And so there's been a real shift in the generation below mine where young mothers have no experience with babies. That is now common. That was not common when I was in my 20s and 30s. Everybody had siblings. They were babysitters. We've lost all that. And so these young women who, you know, in other arenas are so completely confident, fall apart as mothers. That infuriates me as a feminist, because I feel like here was an arena in which women always had ownership, always were confident, and now the culture is undermining them. And
yeah,
I hate that.
I agree with you, because I think a lot of what women have been told is they have to be more like men. Just, you know, leave your kids at home, go be successful in the workplace. And there has not been any adaptation to how do we fit families together. And it's been a disservice to fathers as well. So
absolutely. And it's very different in Europe, where there is daycare at the workplace, where mothers and fathers get time off. Of course, you know, the only industrialized nation that has no parental leave,
which is outrageous. Absolutely.
I got nothing at Cornell. Nothing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Absolutely. So just kind of getting to the end of my questions here, are there certain parenting practices that you would consider closest to our biological norm of what we have practiced since we became humans?
Well, I think, you know, the big three are co-sleeping, you know, which is amazing that you have to give it a name. I remember when the book was first coming out and some interviewer said, what do you think of attachment parenting? And it was the first time I ever heard that word. And my response was, what other kind of parenting could there be? I mean, I just couldn't even get it. Anyway, sleeping with the baby, carrying the baby all the time. My brother-in-law had lived in Zimbabwe for a semester, and he said, you know, Meredith, Zimbabweans carry their babies all the time. And I said, yeah. He goes, no, I mean all the time. And I said, yeah, I know. You know, so just carrying them, I don't know why that is such a big deal, why they have to be put in strollers and pushed around. I just don't get it. It's so much easier You can go in and out of an elevator more easily, exactly. Up and down stairs, everywhere. And the other is breastfeeding on cue. And what Jim is now calling breast sleeping. When you sleep with the baby, it's very easy to breastfeed. The baby is doing it. Mother is not doing much of anything. So those are the three things. And interestingly, they all have to do with physical touch.
Absolutely.
And I, you know, no one's ever studied this, but we're in a culture where people have commitment problems. And I hypothesize that much of that comes from the fact that we expect our babies and children to be physically removed from us when they're awake and when they're asleep. And I think it's not how humans are designed.
Absolutely. I also think that so much of it is people, some people may believe this, but they also feel isolated because they don't have any help. And if they feel like the one parent, it's all on them. So if they can find a way to kind of make their own tribe, it's a little hard now in the time of the pandemic, but if they can find other people to co-parent with, whether it's their partner or, you know, family members nearby, friends, so that they can have ways to hand the baby off when they need a break. That's another thing I think that's missing in our culture.
I think three people is the perfect number, three adults to one infant. And, you know, new American parents can't grasp, understandably so, that this won't last forever. It doesn't last very long. When I look at my 23-year-old, all I want to do is pick her up and hold her, you know, but that isn't happening.
Exactly.
But when you carry your kid a lot, the physicality of it becomes such a normal part of life and affects you, not just the baby. They cry less. We know the research on this. They cry less. And you miss that time. And so basically I say to people, who cares what other people say to you? You know, get as many people around you as you can and really do that. You'll be happier. You'll sleep better.
Absolutely. Yeah. I feel the same way about my children. It seemed like it was forever at the time. It never would change. And now they're adults and I'm like, what happened? Where did it go? I would like to put them in a sling and cuddle them.
I also think for new parents, here they are with this new human being and it's so intense and it's so different if you don't know anything about babies. And what gets lost sight of, which a friend of mine, a good piece of advice, she said to me, there are challenges and rewards at every age. And by the time your kid is walking and talking, you realize, oh, right, now there's going to be this, and then there's going to be that, and then there's going to be this. And that's what being a parent is all about. It really is the whole journey, not those first dependent days.
Absolutely. You know, and I also think about these other cultures where they don't read books, they don't look at sleep tracking apps, they don't read the internet constantly. You know, it's okay. Babies will forgive you if you make a mistake. It's okay.
There's an issue of control in Western culture and the idea that you can control everything. And I think the virus here is certainly a good example of how we can't. And it's really about relaxing and enjoying. Yeah, nobody likes it when a baby cries. Nobody likes to change diapers. But, you know, there's all the other stuff, which is glorious.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So I have one final closing question. If the entire world's knowledge was lost and you could only leave one sentence for future generations, what would it be?
It would be just the word relax.
I agree. I agree. I think people are so wound up now, and if they could just relax and enjoy their babies, it would make a huge difference.
I had a colleague who, you know, loved being a dad, and he and his wife did the kind of parent we're talking about, and he said he would be around people that all be complaining about their kids, and his wife would just go, we're having a great time, you know, and it was unusual. It was unusual to say, this is fabulous, you know.
Absolutely. Well, Meredith Small, it has been just such a delight to talk to you. I really appreciate your taking the time. Again, my guest is Dr. Meredith Small. Small, Professor Emerita at Cornell University, and her newest book is on called Inventing the World, Venice and the Transformation of Western Culture. And my favorite book...
Talk about a pivot.
Absolutely, a big pivot. But my favorite book that she's written is called Our Babies, Ourselves, How Biology and Culture Shape the Way We Parent. So thank you so much, Meredith. It's been an absolute joy.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.